Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We get together here at KHOI Community Radio once a week, live, Tuesday noon, and you can catch us again 7 p.m. in the evening on Tuesday if you just can't get enough of us. So welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Join us around our kitchen table. We will be talking about lots of different things today, food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions. We kind of talk about lots of things.
Oh, we have opinions.
And you'll hear them too, yes. So we had a lovely weekend. There was so much going on.
Oh, my goodness.
Here.
It was a wild weekend.
In central Iowa, we just had so much to do here in the Ames area. We had Maximum Ames, which was music in every little place you could put it, and just all kinds of goodness.
It was so much fun. We had a number of concerts right here in the radio studio, and the stage was called, what was it called? It was cute. Evan, what was it called?
It was called the Flavor Basket Memorial Stage.
It was so cute.
Lovely. It is.
Lindsay Nissen sort of cut this blacked out paper with different stars and things and put it all across our front window. And that was the backdrop for the stage. And then, of course, Evan set the sound system up. And it was really fun. Really, really fun.
Music all over the place. Maximum Ames is a fine thing to happen here in the
There was something at Morning Bell Coffee, at the library. Where else was it, Evan? It was
Ames Final Grind, Dino's, DG Staff House, London Underground all hosted after parties, as did Della Vitti, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, here at the station, we ended up having about five concerts throughout the weekend.
What a nice thing
to
do.
It was a real merry-go-round.
It was.
On top of that was the Octagon Arts Festival all day Sunday in the street.
Which was a fine festival. Music happened there, too. And lots of good things happened at the Octagon Art Festival. I always find something there. You know, you think, I don't need any more jewelry. I don't need any more art. But you always find a little something because it's just really fun. And also, the Central Iowa Barn Dance had a fine barn dance.
You called, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Oh, boy.
To the music of Circle Right, which was Billy Kearney and folks. It's just so nice to have folks get together and be joyful and graceful together. That's kind of what we do.
Yes, Central Iowa Barn Dance. Artful weekend, to say the least.
Artful. Yes, it was. Besides that, this is the time of the year to be putting the garden to bed. That's what I've been doing in between.
I don't know. I can't get mine to go to sleep. It is a riot right now.
Well, mine is giving up in stages, and so I'm pulling out ratty-looking tomato vines. And you realize that if you don't do it now, that's just ever so much more work in the spring. So I've been kind of tidying and saving seeds. And there's still, of course, lots of things to find at farmer's market. There's lots of fall vegetables, and apples are coming, and honey, and there's all kinds of things to eat. But the height of the summer is kind of saying goodbye.
Well, I do find that my Trombuccino vine has gotten so dense, I think that there are lots of little squash still coming along and hiding out in there.
It might do you well to push those leaves aside and see if you've got some good squash.
I've been poking around it intertwined with the tomato, which hardly ever produced anything, and the Tithonia, it's just a riot, the whole thing.
So we're having a nice longish summer, and we are sliding into fall, but it is time to kind of think of
garden. We did pass the equinox, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Right, so we are now officially autumnal.
We are. And this is the time of year that CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, there is bounty all over the place. If you are part of a CSA, you know what I'm talking about. People are having fine jobs of dealing with all that good food they get in their weekly box of good food from community-supported agriculture farmers. And we're just glad that people do that. If you're not a member of a CSA, consider one for next year. There's some to look into here. Ask around at farmer's market, and you can find yourself a community-supported agriculture.
And also at Farm to Folk.
Yes.
Just Google Farm to Folk, all one word.
Yes. Very good. So, speaking about food and eating and farmers, we live on one small planet, and that one small planet takes good care of us. This same Earth provides us with food, and we eat it. We don't even think about that much. We eat, we live. Today, we'll explore what scientists have found out lately about our food supply. Donna's been doing some interesting
reading. Yeah, we're
going
to get a little wonky here. We're going to talk about some of the science. But, and you're going to have to bear with me because I'm going to actually read some of these things, particularly this first one, because I think it's so, so important. This came out about 10 days ago. I think it was published by Politico. It's Jeff Johnson, that's G-E-O-F-F, Johnson for Political, Politico. I would encourage anyone to read the full article because I'm just going to excerpt about 25% of it. But the title of the article is called The Great Nutrient Collapse. So this is a serious piece of research that's just emerging. The great nutrient collapse. The atmosphere is literally changing the food we eat for the worst, and almost no one is paying attention. So there's this researcher whose name I'm not going to pronounce properly.
It's a great name. Give me a try on this. It's a great name. Irakli Ladatsi. I think that's his name.
I was thinking Ladatsi. Right? So we're going to be calling him Ladatsi. Anyway, So he is a mathematician by training, but he was in a biology lab when he encountered the puzzle that would change his life. It was 1998, and Ladatsi was studying for his PhD at Arizona State University. So he's in there puttering around, and it's full of zooplankton. So zooplankton are microscopic animals that float in the world's oceans and lakes. And for food, they rely on algae, which are essentially tiny plants. Scientists found that they could make algae grow faster by shining more light onto them, increasing the food supply for the zooplankton, which should have flourished. You know, more is better, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work out that way. When the researchers shined more light on the algae grew faster, and the tiny animals had lots and lots to eat. But at a certain point, they started struggling to survive. This was a paradox. More food should lead to more growth. How could more algae be a problem? So Lola Dazzi was technically in the math department, but he loved biology and couldn't stop thinking about this. It's sort of like the inverse of multiplication. It didn't work. So the biologist had an idea what was going on. The increased light was making the algae grow faster, but they ended up containing fewer of the nutrients that the zooplankton needed to thrive. By speeding up their growth, the researchers had essentially turned the algae into junk food. The zooplankton had plenty to eat, but their food was less and less nutritious, and so they were starving. Now, does that draw to mind any parallels in our current American food system?
Okay. Goodness.
Okay, so Lola Dadze used his math training to help measure and explain the algae zooplankton dynamic. He and his colleagues devised a model that captured the relationship between a food source and a grazer that depends on the food. They first published that paper in 2000, but Lola Dadze was captivated by the much larger question raised by the experiment: just how far this problem might extend.
Right. I mean,
we're not worried about the algae and the zooplankton here. It's our own skins,
that is
right?
The base of the food system. That's important. But this is, like I said, this is the same planet, and we do eat food, and we eat plants. So what's the story here?
What struck me is that its application is wider, Lola Zali. Lola, say that for me again.
Lola Dazzi,
okay, recalled in the interview. Could the same problem affect grass and cows? What about rice and people? It was kind of a watershed moment for me when I started thinking about human nutrition. So he goes on, the article goes on. In the outside world, the problem isn't that plants are suddenly getting more light. It's that for years, we've been putting more carbon dioxide into the system. Plants rely on both light and carbon dioxide to grow. If shining more light results in faster growing, less nutritious algae, junk food algae whose ratio of sugar to nutrients was out of whack, then it seemed logical to assume that ramping up carbon dioxide might be the same thing.
That'd be nice to know.
Yeah, okay. Because we're heading into it here. That's what climate change is based on. So the junk food effect that he had learned about in the Arizona lab also appeared to be occurring in field and forest around the world. Every leaf and every glass blade on Earth makes more and more sugars as the CO2 levels keep rising, Lolo Dadzi said. Quote, we are witnessing the greatest injection of carbohydrates into the biosphere in human history, an injection that dilutes other nutrients in our food supply. He published those findings just a few years ago, adding to the concerns of a small but increasingly worried group of researchers who are raising unsettling questions about the future of our food supply. Now, this is not the guys that are out saying we have to grow more corn because we have to feed the world. Okay. This is a whole other set of scientists that are concerned about things besides the quantity of food on the planet.
We're talking nutrition. One does not live by cheese doodles alone.
Okay. Could carbon dioxide have an effect on human health that we have not accounted for yet? The answer appears to be yes. And along the way, it steered Lolo Dadzi and other scientists directly into some of the thorniest questions in their profession, including just how hard it is to do research in a field that doesn't yet exist.
So people aren't asking the question.
What's so good about the article. Well, it's interesting because, of course, his field is mathematics, which is siloed from biology. So he had a lot of trouble getting research funding, papers published. It says, in agricultural research, it's been understood for some time that many of our most important foods have been getting less nutritious. Measurements of fruits and vegetables show that their mineral, vitamin, protein content has measurably dropped just over the past 50 to 75 years. Researchers have generally assumed the reason is fairly straightforward. We've been breeding and choosing crops for higher yields rather than nutrition, and higher yielding crops, whether broccoli, tomatoes, or wheat, tend to be less nutrient-packed. In a 2004 landmark study of fruits and vegetables found that everything from protein to iron and calcium and vitamin C had declined significantly across most garden crops since 1950. The research concluded that this could mostly be explained by the varieties that we were choosing to grow. I have to interject that there has also been a lot of research that shows that we have soil nutrient depletion because of the NPK that we've just been kind of feeding instead of really building and composting. So I assumed that those were the two factors, the changes in soil quality and breeding varieties. So this whole thing about the CO2 is a new thing. So Lolo Dadzi and a handful of other scientists have come to suspect that that's not the whole story and that the atmosphere itself may be changing the food we ate. Plants need carbon dioxide to live like humans need oxygen. And in the increasingly polarized debate about climate science, the one thing that is not up for debate is that the level of CO2 in the atmosphere is rising. Before the Industrial Revolution, the Earth's atmosphere had about 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Last year, the planet crossed over the 400 parts per million threshold. Scientists predict we will likely reach 550 parts per million within the next half century, essentially twice the amount that was in the air when Americans started farming with tractors. If you're someone who thinks about plant growth, this seems like a good thing. It has also been useful ammunition for politicians looking for reasons to worry less about the implications of climate change. Representative Lamar Smith, a Republican who chairs the House Committee on Science, recently argued that people shouldn't be too worried about rising CO2 levels because it's good for plants. And what's good for plants is good for us. Quote, higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere would aid photosynthesis, which in turn contributes to increased plant growth, the Texas Republican wrote. This correlates to a greater volume of food production and better quality food. But as the zooplankton experiment showed, greater volume and better quality might not go hand in hand. In fact, they might be inversely linked. As best scientists can tell, this is what happens. Rising CO2 revs up photosynthesis, the process that helps plants transform sunlight to food. This makes them grow, but it also leads them to pack in more carbohydrates, like glucose, at the expense of other nutrients that we depend on, like protein, iron, and zinc. This particular mathematician slash biologist had a lot of trouble getting his research funded. Finally, a few other people jumped into the research. Samuel Myers, a doctor turned climate researcher at Harvard, who leads the Planetary Health Alliance, a new global effort to connect the dots between climate science and human health. He published a large data-rich study in Nature Journal that looks at the key crops grown at several sites in Japan, Australia, and the United States, and also found that rising CO2 led to a drop in protein, iron, and zinc. It was the first time the issue had attracted any real media attention.
Ooh, so when we're talking about feeding the world here, okay.
And Meyer says that his research is just the tip of the iceberg. It's been hard for us to get people to understand how many questions we should have about climate change, right? Mm-hmm. So he said the public health implications of global climate change are difficult to predict, and we expect many surprises. The findings that rising atmospheric CO2 lowers the nutritional values of C3 crops. Okay, so C3 crops, that's 95% of the plants that grow on the planet, including all the things we eat, like wheat, rice, potatoes. So the findings that the atmospheric CO2 lowers the nutritional value of C3 crops is one such surprise that we can now better predict and prepare for. So 2014 research, which is more recent, shows that his rather strong suspicion in 2002 appears to be borne out. Across nearly 130 varieties of plants and more than 15,000 samples collected over the past three decades, the overall concentrations of minerals like calcium, magnesium, potassium, zinc, and iron have dropped by 8% on average. The ratio of carbohydrates to minerals is going up. What that means for humans, whose main food intake is plants, is only just starting to be investigated. Researchers who dive into it will have to surmount obstacles like low profile and slow pace of research and a political environment where the word climate is enough to derail funding conversations. So this is a big deal. This study, in the article, it also quotes a lot of leading nutritionists. When they were shown this research, they went, oh, my goodness, I had no idea. This is serious. This is a good wake-up call. More will be heard about this, I'm sure, in the future, hopefully.
Well, yes, just as someone who eats food. Okay, everything is based on plants. Okay, even if you eat lots of good old meat.
Well, yeah.
That's based on
grass, right, or corn, as it were, and the nutrients and all those things are declining, and, you know, we could be like the zooplankton, plenty to eat and starve to death. It's as if you had to eat, what should we pick, white bread? If you had a total diet of white bread and Cheetos, for example.
Well, that sounds good.
Eventually, it just wouldn't work.
Right. It wouldn't. And think we've evolved so slowly and so perfectly with the planet for such a long time that we just take it as a rule of thumb. You eat an apple,
right,
and it's good for you. Eat the whole thing. What if you're eating, what if the bread that you're making is about, I don't know, 8% less nutritious? Well, does that mean you
the protein in a bread wheat run anywhere from, oh, goodness, I think a high one is 12 to 14. That's very high protein for a wheat, and it goes down from there. But that's significant when you lose 8% of the protein in your diet.
Right.
I mean, not for us big meat eaters maybe, but think of populations that are really relying on plants. I mean, this is a big, serious consideration.
And also consider people whose food budget may not extend to buying fancy extra supplements or whatever. However,
no,
we're going
less,
to,
and we're all supposed to eat less meat. So I would encourage everyone to take a look at this. So it's from Politico, P-O-L-I-T-I-C-O. It's written by Helena Butmiller-Evich, E-V-I-C-H. It was published on 9/13/2007, and it is called The Great Nutrient Collapse. Be sure to, if you have the time, or watch, there will be more about this. This is
yes.
serious.
Yes. Inquiring minds would like to know, I think. Just the nutrient collapse information itself is disturbing, but we do live in an era now where science is poo-pooed and not
like
not,
faux science.
Yeah.
And there is faux science.
Yes, there it's is.
Who is this science funded by? Now, yep. when you get a researcher like this that hardly can find funding, mm-hmm. you know that the big multi-food national corporations are not paying for this. There's not an implicit commercial bias at all.
Right, right. And you have to worry about things because...
Yeah. Who do you trust?
Who do you trust? And so does this relate to how healthy we are? It actually, I read this article too, and there was a little paragraph in there too that bees are having trouble.
And, oh, yes. He does talk about
yeah,
that
and
if the bees are getting – they did an experiment mm-hmm. because they wanted to just pick a tiny little subset to mm-hmm. see how it affected. And they did conclude that lower nutrients in the bees' food, which would be the pollens, mm-hmm. Are a contributing factor to colony
collapse.
Well,
see? See? And we're part of this world, too. The bees
yeah,
and
the
us.
Yeah, human colony here.
Right. So that's an... Yeah,
so stay tuned. Stay tuned. This climate change, it's really, really... It's not just about hurricanes and inundations.
Things can change in a big way. And when it affects our food system, perhaps we will sit up and take notice. Yes, we will. Yes, we will. This is KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was some music by fine piano player, some original music by fine piano player Reginald R. Robinson from his CD Man Out of Time. We'll hear more from him later. We're talking about being informed. Sometimes there's news that we may not want to hear, but it's nice to know about things, especially when it affects us so deeply. We all have to eat. And when there are little things that might be affecting our food supply, I think maybe we should, like, take notice, take our nose out of the devices that we put them into all the time and raise our eyes to the field and see what's going on out there.
Yeah, stop watching those cat videos.
Cat video. They may save us yet. You never know. But
I did read a stress reduction article said...
Very good.
They're not... If you don't do it too much, they're not a bad idea.
Oh, very good. See, I like cats. They're good. So Donna has been bringing us some information that she's been finding about nutrition. And unfortunately, she read an article about nutrition collapsing. Not collapsing as in falling apart altogether.
Declining, for sure.
Right. Declining. So are there things we can do? Are there things we have to be aware of? Yes.
This is another book. Fred Kirschman had been mentioning this book, and I didn't get it. And finally, we have it at the library. So it's called The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. It's David Montgomery, who has been speaking. He's spoken in the Great Hall a couple of years ago. He is a geologist. His book that he was talking about at the time was called Dirt, The Erosion of Civilization. So this new book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health, it's something he and his wife wrote. And what he's saying, this goes back to something I know I've said on the radio many, many, many times. I say, we can send a man to the moon. Our science knows how to do that. But we still don't know what's going on within our, you know, about human nutrition, what our bodies, what's in our bellies and stuff.
And how does that work? Yes.
Right. So this is about that. It's a story of actually his wife's gardening, and then she got cancer, and then they did more research. And so what he's saying is essentially, like the first sentence of the introduction says, we are living through a scientific revolution as illuminating as the discovery that the Earth orbits the sun. So what he's talking about is that we now, you know, early botanists and nutritionists, usually only for millennia, we could only talk about what we could see with our eyes. So it, actually in the very recent past, we've discovered, you know, with DNA sequencing and tiny, tiny microscopes, we can now understand the much smaller biota of our ecosystems. I'm going to just read this one paragraph here. The latest revelations about microorganisms show that we are not who we thought we were. This was brought into sharp relief a few years ago when a large consortium of scientists reported in the journal Science and Nature an unfathomably vast array of invisible life. Bacteria, protists, arachnia, and fungi. No, I didn't say that right. Arachnia, spiders. A-R-A-C-H-A-E. Anyway.
Arachia,
okay.
Well, they're probably connected.
Anyway, they thrive on us and in us, as do innumerable viruses, which are not considered alive. Their cells outnumber our own cells. This is in our body.
Oh, my.
By at least 3-1, and many people say 10-1. Yet we are only beginning to learn what they do for us and our planet. Like the bodies of plants, animals, and people, our whole planet is literally covered inside and out with microorganisms. Not only are they abundant, they're robust, able to withstand the most extreme conditions that the planet can offer. The new name for the microbes that live within us and on us are called the human biome.
Oh.
It talks about... you know, we've had this paradigm of killing germs since the since the Pasteurs discovered the whole thing. But what we're finding out is the vast majority of these tiny little things, which we know very little about and are only beginning to study, are our best allies. So just like people now know, okay, eat your yogurt so you get those live probiotics inside your belly. That's just the teeniest bit of what's going on, and it is extraordinary. And once we learn to coexist more consciously and understand what these things do and appreciate them more, not only will we improve our soil, but we can improve our health. Now, also, if we improve our soil, Hello, it will pull some of that carbon out of the air, right?
Uh-huh.
It's all, we are all one, folks.
Speaking of biomes, I think that's the whole darn planet.
Right,
yes,
we are all relations.
Yes, it is. The very simple childlike view of eating. Well, you kind of shovel things in. It's kind of like a furnace in there, right? And you kind of – it's like a steam engine. And I think it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's decidedly complex but intricately beautiful, I'm sure, as we will begin to discover. I mean, and the strange thing is really – It's only maybe in the last 10 years that we've even been looking at this. It's shocking.
People are asking questions, and we should find
out. How did we decide, as a nation, that it was more important to go to the moon than to understand what's going on inside our bodies?
It's showier. Makes better TV.
I guess so.
That. But just think with the microbes. It's not just, like, maintenance every day, but – we grow. We heal.
Oh, cellular
we change.
Repair and waste control. I mean, all those little bits of cells that are dying and growing and changing. You know, our body has to move all of this stuff around.
It's a good thing we don't have to do it with our brains. Otherwise, you wouldn't get anything else done.
Way too complex for our little punny human intelligence. Yeah. Even the smartest of us could never even... Can imagine if it's like even if you had to think about breathing all the time. Oh my goodness! So the book.
Yeah, we have enough to do to just get this radio show
one
together.
Foot that's in front of the other, man.
That's it.
Okay, the hidden half of nature, the microbial roots of life and health. David R. Montgomery and his wife Anne
Bickley.
Okay,
there you go.
It is at the library. However, I have checked it out for right now.
So there, put a hold on it. Yes, very good. Since Don has been giving me this information and passing along this information to me, I found some other things, too. And here they are.
It's all on the Internet, folks.
Oh, yes.
Oh, boy, oh, boy.
And I just thought, this is a thing to talk about around a kitchen table, and here's a thing to talk about at noon.
I think it's true. This is a service that Lana and I are performing. Since we've looked at these issues for... probably a combined at least 60 years.
Yeah.
When we go grazing through the internet, we can pull and highlight the most very relevant things. And we can also, we weed out the junk science too.
Yeah.
So listen up, folks.
And if you disagree with us, well, that's fine. Anyway, so put down your big Slurpee and your Big Mac there and here, listen up. 10 foods to avoid if you don't want to be in a bad mood. Certain foods can make you feel depressed. Your body reacts to this.
Couldn't be those carbohydrates and sugars.
I'm going to read them just like they do on the TV from number 10 on down. Agave, number 10. Here's the one you might not have expected, but agave is full of fructose, which can affect your metabolism. Okay? Coffee. It destabilizes you. Yes, it does.
It doesn't say not to eat it.
It says
just to be moderate in
it. And these are mood destabilizing things, so be aware. Alcohol. I bet you saw that one coming. There we go. Okay. Then drink among friends. That's fine. But it causes stress, anxiety, and reduces serotonin levels. Huh?
Okay. Now, serotonin is the one that helps you to sleep, to relax, you know.
Okay. Number 7, holiday hams and lunch meat. You never know what's in those things, so watch out there. And
Read the labels.
Mm-hmm. Number
Some
6.
Some are better than others.
Vegetable shortening. There's harmful fats.
That's your trans fats in the...
There you go.
Which would gradually the industry is trying to remove from most of the products because it's... really bad stuff.
There we go. Number 5, margarine. whole lot of processed fats mess with your moods.
Another trans fat. Mm-hmm. Watch the oils.
Right.
Stick with your lard and your butter.
There you go.
Yeah. And olive oil, of course.
Yeah. Number four, potato chips and French fries. Heaven knows where they've been.
It's the fats again.
Again, yeah, again. Uh-huh. And because we consume such huge amounts of that stuff, there's a lot of pesticides and things going into just growing the potatoes and the chips and all that kind of stuff. Be careful.
Just don't eat too much.
Don't eat too much. And salt. Okay. All right. Number three, gluten. Yeah, you're probably sick about hearing about gluten, but...
And it applies to some people more than others.
Some people more than others. So just be aware of it.
But especially watch out for the white flours. Nobody needs that much white flour. Whole wheat's a little better because the bran and the wholeness of the wheat slows the digestive process and it doesn't spike your insulin as much.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways of telling you might have a gluten problem is mental fog. You feel a little kind of out of it, and that would just be careful. Gluten does affect. Number two, refined carbs. Okay.
Huh? Okay, that would be your white flour your sugars.
Mm-hmm.
And all, you know, and your Cheetos. Sorry, we're really picking on Cheetos today. It's just an iconic product.
I love to eat Cheetos.
Oh, me too. They're my favorite junk food.
We are not purists here, but be careful. A 2015 study found that over 70,000 women had found that diets high in refined foods contributed to an increased risk of depression. Huh? We don't like depression.
Not to mention, you get fat.
That too.
That can make you depressed.
Well, that can make you depressed. Number one of the 10 foods to avoid if you don't want to be in a bad mood, added sugars.
Sugar.
Just be aware of this. Be aware. This stuff affects us.
It's in everything. I, of course, am not capable of giving up sugar, but I do try to be selective. So I really... If something's really good and it's homemade and it's, in fact, we're going to talk about a raspberry dessert next, I take my sugars sparingly. So I try to pick the most fun ones.
Right. I guess when you think about all these things that we ingest, be aware that it's not just you that you're eating for, but you're eating for all those microbes in there that are doing your best.
Yeah,
we're
and
all
the,
in this.
The sugar is not particularly good for some. You know what? I try to treat sugars, and I do this with caffeine too. It's like I have a bank balance. If I spend too much, I'm going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't consume too much of those things and try to keep myself balanced.
Good. Nothing like a good candy bar for balance. But a good one. A good one.
Yeah, with lots of really dark chocolate that has less sugar in it.
Yeah.
For example.
And taste is a wonderful broad spectrum. So there's a lot of things we can learn to taste and eat. This is KHOI. We'll listen to some more ragtime music, the Ragtime Jamboree.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about nutrition, eating good for you, and eating food that is, we'll get into some food that's real fun to eat, too. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this fine show at khoifm.org. This is community radio, and there's a web page there. You can find out lots of wonderful shows.
And an archive. You can listen to any past show that your heart desires.
Yes. The Donna Lana Kitchen also has a web page. We even have a recipe page.
That's
wouldn't
right.
you know?
That's
wouldn't
right.
you know? And if you want to contact us, khoiradio@gmail.com. Raspberries. This is the season for raspberries.
This is our last berry cup, except for cranberries, which are different. But yeah, this is the last hurrah for the berries of the season.
And they're just doing beautifully on my farm. And I've struggled for years and to get nice domestic raspberries to grow. And I put in some last year, didn't have much hope for it. And now they're doing beautifully. I found out that my Corgi loves to eat the raspberries. He gets all the low ones.
Rascal.
He does. He's eaten quite a few. So here's a little bit about raspberries from a potted history of fruit. The raspberry. Rubus ideus. Raspberries are grown commercially in all temperate regions of the world. Most are cultivars of the European red raspberry and the American red raspberry, but there are also yellow raspberries or golden raspberries, and much less well known are the blue raspberry, the dark purple, which is almost black, but it is not a blackberry. And there is a blackberry in Russia called the Arctic raspberry, which is called the berry of kings. And the only people in the northern part of Russia, Scandinavia, and northern Canada can enjoy that. Evidently, it's really something. But I do like a red raspberry. Oh, they're so good when they're still kind of warm from the vine. But you pick some. I'll pick some every day. I found out that I planted my berries in the wrong place, of course.
Well, yes, this is an admission of a consummate gardener.
Yeah,
so.
Right. You can bury them. That's a good place to put them, right along the edge of the garden there. And I did. I in well-drained soil. I put a lot of compost in there, and they came up beautifully. And then here I'm reading down in how to grow raspberries. I'm gonna read the steps here. It says, do not plant them next to tomatoes. So where did I put them? Right next to a row of tomatoes.
Actually, yeah, but they did very well.
They did
your tomatoes. So,
yeah, they're fine. It probably has something to do with pathogens. And the tomatoes will not be there next year, so I will move them. But, yeah. So next year I will, I promise to do this, I will trim the canes down and I will stake them because they will get kind of tall and it'll be more fun to...
Brambly.
Yeah, brambly, more fun to pick them if I don't have to dig around in there. And, of course, I'll have help from my dog.
And the dog will have less of them if you stake them up, right?
Right. So there you go. So lots of different ways to have raspberries.
Well, one of them, and I think I might make, I did make this one year. I'm into doing shrubs. So here's the definition of a shrub.
It's something to drink.
Yeah.
Drink.
A colonial day drink whose name is derived from the Arabic word sharab, to drink. It is a concentrated syrup made from fruit, vinegar, and sugar that is traditionally mixed with water to create a refreshing drink that is simultaneously tart and sweet. In the 19th century, the drink was often spiked with brandy or rum. So this is from the book Shrubs by Michael, Dietsch, Dietsch? Anyway, so he has a raspberry thyme shrub.
Ooh.
Raspberries and thyme are common ingredients in culinary preparation, so why not in a shrub? Drizzle of this, a little of it over goat cheese for an afternoon snack or ice cream for dessert. The shrub also works well with olive oil in a salad dressing. Oh, you want to drink it? Try it with gin and soda on the rocks, or for a lighter touch, dry vermouth and soda. So it's really simple. You take 2 cups of raspberry, 1 cup of sugar, 8 thyme sprigs, and 1 cup of apple cider vinegar.
Oh, vinegar.
So what you do is you put the sugar on the raspberries, and you let them hang out for a couple of days and crush them around, and they, 2 days in the refrigerator, they will juice out, and then you put the thyme into the cider vinegar, and you wait 2 days as well. Then you strain the whole mixture together, you know, getting all the little bits out. And he suggests you pour and re-pour the vinegar over the top of it a couple of times. Make sure you get all of the sugar and the raspberry flavor that you can.
Can you squish it a little bit?
Yes.
Oh, squish it.
Well, you don't. The thing is, when you strain it, you don't want too much plant matter. Well, but then you you put it into a clean mason jar and you shake it well and you let it sit a week before you use it.
In the refrigerator or just in the counter?
Let's see, what does it say?
With the vinegar?
Yes, in the refrigerator.
There you go.
In the refrigerator. So that's 2 days of preparation. Mm-hmm. Then strain it off and put it in the fridge for a week, and then I guess the flavors sort of the flavors would marry. But I also I think if you use a live apple cider vinegar, you would probably get a little fermentation, mm-hmm. Not much in the refrigerator, but probably enough to make it shrubby.
Yeah, and this is the thing that you add to other things.
Vermouth on the rocks.
Okay,
very good,
Donna. I like that.
Okay.
Speaking of vermouth on the rocks, I always think ahead to Christmas for this sort of thing. So I already have taken some of my raspberries, put them in a mason jar, and covered it with vodka.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Let that and
forget about it.
And I do add a little sugar.
A little bit. You don't want it too sweet, but a little bit. Now, do you eventually strain it off, like if you're making a gift or something? Or do you serve it with the raspberries?
My raspberries kind of fell apart this time. I've done it with cherries and things that I just leave it whole.
I have my cherries in my Benedictine and branding waiting for Thanksgiving.
Right. You pour it out and there's a little kerplop of some fruit in the – that's fine. So I think I will strain this because
the
berries are kind of mushy already. It'll be good. It'll be like your shrub.
You'll get a lovely pink color.
Oh, it's already a lovely pink color. The vodka was good. And I didn't get the bottom shelf vodka. I didn't get the top shelf vodka. I got kind of a medium.
Yeah. I shoot for the medium. You don't want to waste the good stuff, but the cheap stuff might ruin the raspberries.
Well, I've tried it with the cheap stuff and wondered, and you just try the cheap stuff by itself? Well, I'd rather have a vodka that at least I could take a sip of.
Yeah, the cheap stuff is supposed to give you a worse hangover, Lana.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I've heard.
That's one thing you can do. And I have a recipe I would like to share.
Oh, yes. This is from one of our favorite cookbook authors. Both Lana and I just adore Nigel Slater.
He's very British.
Oh, his wonderful
sensibility. He's the author of Toast, the story of a boy's hunger. And what's nice, he just writes about food like you just want to sit down and have a meal.
He's a really good writer. And his recipes are usually quite doable and well thought out.
Yeah, he's not fancy. His recipes are based on his experiences with, of course, the London Green Grocers, and they have many more fishmongers, and they have some things over
there. Right, it's very British. But the thing is, he's also not a restaurant chef.
Right.
So he's realistic for home cooking.
I like this.
That's a big difference.
And this book is called The Kitchen Diaries. A year in the kitchen, he kind of just kept a diary. And sometimes he's, we went out for Chinese tonight. We just brought it home and ate it in front of the TV. That was one night. But most of this stuff is
he's very realistic.
He's a very realistic person. Get this. And it does have lovely photographs, too. Here's a recipe. Raspberry vanilla ice cream cake. Ooh, doesn't that sound good?
You buy it and put it together recipe.
You can buy it and put it together. Now, he says you could make your own sponge cake, but then you could also make your own ice cream. So save yourself a little time here and just go to some major food shops.
This is a quick and dirty delight here.
And find a buttery, plain sponge cake. I don't know if grocery stores here, bakeries here, what would you get buttery sponge cake?
I would say probably that there are two possible equivalents, depending on which way. If you want a lighter one, you can always buy angel food cake almost anywhere. Mm-hmm. And if you want it richer and denser, probably you could buy a pound cake.
Yeah, right. Because what this is...
Or lady fingers even. Ooh. But, you know, I mean, if you want to go cakey, those two, you know, you can pick that up in any grocery store. And then the ice cream. I would caution you, if you're going to bother to do something like this, buy the premium ice cream. Get the better quality, the better your dish will be, because it's a big part of the ingredients.
It is. This is a dandy ice cream sandwich. You are making a
layers. Yeah, this is
layers,
the adult ice cream sandwich with raspberries.
Oh.
So
here we
tell us how to do it.
Okay. He said that you can, He also suggests that if you happen to find a cake that has ground almonds in it, that would be good.
But that would be a bit difficult here,
you could probably add some. Oh, it is a plain sponge cake or cake, 3/4 pounds, 2 pints of ice cream, 1 pound of raspberries, and 2 tablespoons of confectioner's sugar to dust. A cake pan, a square lined with plastic wrap, nine inches square.
Okay.
And this wax paper, line it with the wax paper sticking out of the sides. You can lift.
So you can lift it up and
Let the ice cream. You cut the sponge cake or the other cake,
the
pound cake, in half, and line the bottom of the pan with it. Sprinkle raspberries on top, and then let the ice cream soften, but not melted. Push it into the corners over the raspberries, smooth the top, then cover with the remaining raspberries. Cover with reserved slices of sponge cake. And if it falls apart, that's okay. Just kind of push it back together. Cover tightly with plastic wrap.
Wait a minute. So cake, ice cream, then raspberries?
We're going to use the raspberries here. Cake, raspberries, ice cream, raspberries.
Oh, okay.
And then the cover. Freeze for a good half hour. Wrapped in plastic, more like, or you could do it for a few days.
Like the semifreddo,
which is
the Italian version that we talked. We did a peach one in the middle of the summer.
Bring the cake out of the freezer to thaw. And he says a good half hour before you intend to eat it. I know this seems like a long time, but trust me, it takes a long time to soften enough to cut.
Right. You don't want it rock hard.
No. And you dust with confectioner's sugar. So do something a little nice with your raspberries will stand up to this. This is good. Enjoy. This is a good thing.
It's a quick but impressive dessert.
It is. Raspberry, vanilla, ice cream.
You can sort of say,
cake.
I made it. It's homemade.
It is. It's home assembled.
You made it? Right.
That was from the Kitchen Diaries by Nigel Slater. Also, we did a lot of reading and sharing of information today. Give us that website and the book title again.
Okay. So the book from the library was The Hidden Half of Nature, subtitled The Microbial Roots of Life and Health, David Montgomery and Ann Vilke. And also the homework for the week is to look up on Politico, the website, the story called The Great Nutrient Collapse. It was put online on 9/13/2007 by Helena Botmiller-Evich.
Yes.
The Great Nutrient Collapse.
As if we didn't have enough to worry about. Because it seems we're eating many places in the world do not have enough to eat. Here we are in the United States with stuff that we throw away, and we eat and we eat and we eat. And now
we're around us growing all of these, the corn. I would call it, it's turned into a lot of empty calories or else gasoline, you know. So are we really contributing to feeding the world?
Let's not just think about quantity all the time. Let's think about quality and keep your ears open for what our food is actually contributing to our health. I think that's a good thing to consider.
Yes, that is an individual responsibility. One has to read the labels, understand what those mean, take in a bit of the science as much as you can handle, and be careful of the source of the science.
Very good. We can do this.
You have to know the funding of your scientists. This is too complicated.
You have been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks for joining us today. You can hear us Tuesdays at noon or repeated 7 p.m. in the evening on Tuesdays. Every Tuesday on KHOI 89.1 FM. We've had fine ragtime piano music today by Reginald R. Robinson. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Oh, let's go pick some raspberries. Oh, very good. We had engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.